Hey guys, welcome to the Three Drinks In podcast, episode number 140. In this episode, we look at a recent or somewhat recent Twitter poll trend thing going on about the your five perfect movies, movies that you wouldn't change a thing about. So no guest this week. Before we get into it, though, I want to remind you that Three Drinks In is available on iTunes, Google Play, and wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Three Drinks In podcast. You'll easily find us. Click subscribe, tell your friends, and leave a review. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at @ThreeDrinksInPod. You can like us on Facebook, and you can email us at ThreeDrinksInPodcast@gmail.com. That's everything. You ready?
Yep.
Here we go. Sorry. Here we go.
Where did you see this thing? Twitter?
Twitter.com.
Hmm.
Yeah.
You know, I always see those polls on Twitter where it's like, name your five worst work experiences and name five things you've done more than anything. And I'm always like, can't they just go through all the data mining and do this the old-fashioned way? Why do I have to tell them stuff now?
That's true, because... you know, who knows when these things get started? Like, one of them recently was like your like five jobs you've had in your lifetime. Mm-hmm. And you have porn stars up there going like librarian, and then like as they go through it gets progressively more dirty, you know.
You know
stripper bartender, and then or like strip club bartender, and then stripper, and then porn star.
It's like, these are all stuff that, you know, BuzzFeed quizzes with, you know, what kind of toaster strudel are you? Are you strawberry? Are you blueberry? And they just ask you all these questions. And I'm like, oh, that's a pretty transparent way to get me to answer a survey. But now these are literally just survey questions where they ask you stuff.
I mean, it sort of replaced the bar argument. You know, like people used to sit around bars and talk about like the best this and the best that. And so, like somehow like arguments about, you know, actual and like things you can answer kind of went away, you know. And even though bar trivia seems to be on the rise now, it's like a fun thing. Like every town now has one bar that's doing bar trivia. But like, you know, you can't argue about the most popular this or the most common that, because it's all, you know, you just look at your phone. But you can talk about the best, and so things become really more opinion focused, and so you know, you get these lists out of nowhere.
I think there's a little bit of like, they feel very unofficial, so you don't mind disagreeing with them. Like, I'm not gonna answer anybody randomly asking me questions, but like when you see something like on Nerdist, for instance, like here's the definitive ranking of Marvel movies, and you're sitting there going, this is horseshit. If some random stranger says it, you're like, well, you're a moron, but whatever, man. I'll tell you mine. Like you would at a bar.
Yeah. You're like, you wouldn't argue with somebody considered to be a source, but you'd argue with a random guy listing his
right
favorite, you know, popcorn flavors or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And butter pecan, fuck you.
Yeah. Pineapple on pizza. Blah.
I used to like that, and then I didn't like it anymore.
Yeah. Because you had some sense knocked into you.
Yeah, like I like pineapple and ham. I like pizza. And somehow I was like, this is okay, right? And after a while, I'm like, no, this is not okay.
I like Fruit Loops, but I don't like it on my pizza.
Gum and nuts. Together at last.
So we're talking about what? The five best or perfect movies?
Yes, so your five perfect movies. Movies that may not be your absolute favorite movies, but that don't really have any sort of discernible flaws in them. Like I was saying to you before off the air, like I was going to put The Matrix on here, but there are some questions. There's a couple of plot holes in The Matrix, and you know, there's I mean, it's easily in my top 10 if not my top five in terms of favorite movies, but there's like a couple of little things that kind of irk me about it that are weird, you know. Most notably that Keanu Reeves isn't a great actor. I don't know who would have played that part better than him. So maybe this is unfair, but like, I've read for years that Will Smith was their first choice, or was the studio's first choice for the character. And I'm thinking to myself, that really would have been weird.
Yeah, I can't picture anybody else doing that.
Yeah. I mean, I can picture other actors doing it, like sort of, you know, bland, you know, method actors, like, you know, Michael Fassbender. He could have done it, or like, yeah, you know, there's plenty of other sort of standard male handsome actors that could have stepped into that role, because they didn't have a whole lot to do. And the way that Reeves delivers some of the lines, it just kind of clunks out of him, like this is something that he was supposed to say, and so he said it.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't picture somebody like Will Smith, who just is nothing but charm, coming in and trying to do a role where like you really can't have too much personality, because the whole point is that he's doubting himself the whole time, and everyone's trying to imprint upon him a identity that he's not sure he even has.
Right.
So anyway, but so I've got like 9 movies here I have to figure out as we talk.
You always do this.
I do. I do. I always do it.
Stop.
I'm not saying I'm going to give you 9 movies. I'm saying I have them and I have to whittle them down.
Yeah. And then you'll be like, oh, well, I also would have thrown these 5 over. And I'm like, all right.
Yeah.
Why do we have numbers?
I have 3 honorable mentions.
Yeah. So I guess it was difficult to make the list. Perfect movies, really?
Yeah. Well, I'm knocking off Casablanca because I don't know it that well. It's been considered to be a perfect film by other people, but it's been a long time since I've seen it, and it's not really my time period. So I was like, I'm not going to put that one. So now I'm down to 7. Everybody,
mm-hmm.
It all calm down. So why don't you go first if you have yours?
Okay. Well, I actually didn't put Casablanca because it reminds me of A Few Good Men, where it just has this really awkwardly placed flashback scene in it. And you need it in Casablanca to explain why everything is going on. But at the same time, like when it happens, oh man, I'm like, what's going on now? And then like everything, like the plot is now on hold while you get all the backstory.
When does that happen in A Few Good Men?
It happens before they go down to Cuba, and then all of a sudden they flash this scene and you see it's the main guy, Jack Nicholson, and he's talking to his, you know, lieutenants about the kid who's writing letters home.
Oh yeah. And so it starts off with the guy who's dead reading his own letter in a voiceover and transfers to Jack Nicholson. And then it has this great character introduction. That moment is, who the fuck is PFC William Santiago? That's a great little thing.
It's a good scene, but every time it comes up, I'm always like, what is this scene doing here? Like, they had to get that information across somehow, and they just stuck it somewhere, because at that point, the kid's already dead. And I mean, it's basically a scene to get Jack Nicholson more into the movie. But it's still, it always just felt so shoehorned in.
Yeah, I mean, it's important. I've never really thought of it like that. It does stand out in that, like, the rest of the film proceeds along the same timeline. There is no flashback sequences except for that one. And it's a subtle one. Like, it's handled pretty well in that you're hearing Willie's voice for the first time. Like, he doesn't actually speak otherwise in the film.
Well, it also takes away the mystery of what's going on. You know, they're trying to figure out what really happened to this kid. And after that scene, you know for sure, okay, Jack Nicholson is the asshole who told these guys to do it, and he ended up dying. And now we have to somehow prove it. And you're just sort of waiting for that. I was always like, you know, I don't know what you'd do to fix it, because I'm not a Hollywood screenwriter. But I never liked that scene.
If you omitted it, then
Like you're missing information when you take it out. And they didn't, I guess they didn't know how else to put it in.
How much information are you missing though?
You're just getting a better sense of what Jack Nicholson is like and what the other guy who ends up shooting himself is like.
Yeah, but in the movie that I'm writing in my head right now, that it's actually improved without that scene. I never realized it till just now. Because you're right, you take away the mystery of it. There is no mystery in A Few Good Men.
Right.
It's just like, these are the good guys, and these are the bad guys, and these are how the good guys get the bad guys. And if you... I mean, I guess there's some... Because he doesn't explicitly say to him, give him a code red. Do this to him. He does tell... He does say in the Cuba meeting on the terrace when they're eating and it's all fancy that, you know... On the record, I did what I was told. Off the record, I think that code reds are a good thing and we should keep them around. But I guess he's never explicit about the fact that he wants, this is how he wants Kiefer Sutherland's character to deal with the problem. But yeah, you get such a clear sense of the character that it's not ambiguous at all that this is what he intended for him to do.
Right.
So, yeah, I never, interesting, never. I mean, I had that one, I took that one off because I didn't like Demi Moore in that movie. So something about her was, like, and the whole, like, you know, they stand on a wall line is so cheesy.
Yeah. Well, everything she says is cheesy.
Yeah, and she's just so, I don't know. Again, I'm not sure who could have done it better, but anyway.
So anyway, but I actually... I didn't have a hard time doing this, but okay, so in no particular order, the first one I had was The Godfather. It's a perfect movie. It's perfect. Next one I had was Jaws. It's a wonderful film. Wouldn't change anything there. Especially, maybe I would change that they all should be wearing anchor coats.
Or if I all, you mean me?
Yeah, if they could just mail me one, that would be nice. I have L.A. Confidential with Guy Pearce and James Cromwell and all of them.
Sure, sure.
I have The Fellowship of the Ring, the first one. Yeah, so I wouldn't, all the adaptation stuff and that was phenomenal. I wouldn't change anything there. Nice ending. And then I had The Count of Monte Cristo, also with Guy Pearce, which is one of the best book adaptations to film I've ever seen.
You've read that book?
Parts of it. I keep getting interrupted and then I stop. But the story is far better as in a movie. Like when I always say, like, is a movie better than the book? This is one of those times. The only honorable mention I had was Rocky. But Talia Shire is just so horrible.
I have a lot of problems with Rocky.
Yeah. Like, the more I thought about it, I was like, this has got to go.
Yeah, like, Rocky has, like, a giant chunk in, the first 45 minutes just take forever to get anywhere. And, like, some of the scenes aren't bad. Like, the scene where Mickey comes to the apartment and they get into a fight or he kind of shuts them out. Like, those are good scenes, but, like, you know, he's walking around Philadelphia for like an hour before he does anything interesting.
Yeah, and that scene with Mickey is like 6 minutes out of a 2-hour movie.
Yeah, you know, and the weird scene where like Paulie throws Thanksgiving dinner out in the... It's an odd... It's not bad. It's just odd. It's like it's... That's the thing, like Rocky's so iconic. You know, they made 48 movies about it. You kind of and like they're all worse than the first one, even if you like some of them. It's sort of hard to go back and say, well, this is the best of these movies, but there's still kind of this thing and that thing about it, and yeah. Okay, so all right, let me just write that. So you had L.A. Confidential. I keep track of everything. Jaws, Godfather. What else did you say?
Fellowship of the Ring.
Fellowship. Ship. And the fifth one was
Count of Monte Cristo.
Count of Monte Cristo. With that Rocky being. Okay. Interesting. Well, So here's why Fellowship wouldn't be on my list. And it's mostly because, like, to me, there's a problem with, and this handled as best they could, but the relationship between Frodo and Sam was really hard, I think, for the filmmakers to deal with. Because in the books, Sam is basically Frodo's valet. You know, he's his body man. He's his subordinate.
Mm-hmm.
And in the egalitarian world of today, when we're making movies now, that wouldn't translate well. Like, it does fine in, like, Downton Abbey, when the whole point is to showcase upstairs, downstairs. But they didn't want to do that. And so the core relationship in the story is of these two people. But it was weird that, like, Frodo was obviously younger than Sam. Like the actors themselves are just younger than the other one. And I don't think Sean Astin's a very good actor. He's not bad. Like, he did a short stint on The Big Bang Theory this season that was kind of funny. But not very. And so, like, he was sort of eager to play the sort of subordinate role to Elijah Wood's Frodo, and it never really coalesced because they didn't let him do it. Like, they didn't want him to be considered the inferior to, and that's really what it was. I mean, this is a guy writing, you know, in Britain in the early part of the 20th century. These kind of relationships between classes of citizens were common, and so they didn't want to highlight that, but they couldn't shy away from it at the same time because it's baked into the story. And I don't know. That's what, like, just, that's usually what gets it for me, is one actor in a movie will just kind of screw with it. Where I'll go, that could have been better. Like, The Godfather isn't on my list either. Because even though I consider it to be the best movie of all time, Talia Shire sucks there too. And she doesn't suck in that as much as she sucks in Rocky, in the subsequent Rocky movies. But, like, and she does have a powerful scene when she breaks all the dishes and Carlo beats her half to death. But, like, just there's something, I don't know, something about her. And I never loved What's-Her-Face, Kay. Who plays Kay in that movie? Diane Keaton.
Right.
You know, she's really good. You know, it's as good as it gets, I think. I'm not sure who plays it better, but, like, something about it kind of bugs me. But so, like, it's just, again, like, I kind of held the bar pretty high. I go, okay, I would recast that character because I don't like Talia Shire.
But she just, see, my wife said the same thing because she was like, oh, God, even her, she's so annoying. And she is annoying, but she's only supposed to be this whiny, spoiled, sheltered person who marries a brute, you know, who's looking out for himself. So when she sits there whining and crying, I'm like, you know, it's, she doesn't do anything else besides that. Like, they don't give her all these big acting scenes. She's always freaking out or something. So playing a woman in, like, this spoiled anguish, I think she had down pretty well. You know what they say about women in horror movies, like, you don't have to act, but can you scream and look afraid? And some girls are good at that, and some are not.
I think there was an entire, like, reality show called Scream Queens, which is what they were trying to, like, that was the thing. Like, you had to show that you could act in a horror film.
No, I think that was a drama.
Was it?
Yeah.
Isn't I? What am I thinking of?
I don't know what you're thinking. I think you're just thinking of people getting up in front of a microphone and screaming into it. I think you might have dreamed that.
Oh, I don't know why. Like, because my wife knows somebody who was on that show,
Yeah, it was like a comedy drama show. It wasn't
Oh,
real.
I thought it was like a reality show where like you had to do something. Oh, I can't think of the name of the damn person who they knew. But they had Jamie Lee Curtis on it. In it,
Yeah, it
which
was
is
like a
like,
f
which
funny cameo.
oh, okay. I thought that like,
She was like the
yeah, that's what I thought.
judge.
Yeah, I'm not really paying attention.
Apparently.
But anyway, I'm trying to look for that person's name that they knew and I can't find it. Anyway, so yeah, like yeah, you're right. Like she didn't have to do much of anything. But I don't know. I just it's as close as you get to, and then you have that one thing bother me. It's just I think they could have gotten a better actress to play that part. I mean, she ended up being in all these movies because they, you know, everyone knew each other. Everyone's casting everybody else's relatives and things. And, you know, I don't know. It was just
Yeah,
close.
but I mean, she's not in it that much. Well, in Rocky, she's in half the movie,
Right.
so.
Yeah. No, it was, she's worse than Rocky. She definitely kind of, t you know, would
I think
sink
that.
Rocky if this, if that was your only thing about Rocky you didn't like.
Right. I think the thing with the Lord of the Rings is that in the book, you're right, he's the subordinate, but more than class, it's more that he's not. He's supposed to be younger. Than Elijah Wood, for one thing, but he's also dumber and emotionally immature,
Yeah.
and like, for lack of a better term, simple. And his thing at the end of the book is that he's matured enough. He's seen the world, and big concepts are once again he's able to grasp, and he has a humble heart. He's like the humble gardener. He was a very Christian person, very Catholic. The
Yeah.
Tolkien, and they cut all that stuff out. He's just like a little bit naive in the film.
And a little bit too. He's much more like the only really like crazy naive thing they do is in the beginning when they start to cook themselves bacon and sausages in that that place where they're hiding, and then the Nazgul find them. After that, they're quite world weary. Like they're very much scared and going, okay, this is for real. We are not joking around anymore.
Yeah, the other two take on that role. They become comic relief, and they become the ones who like are out of their depth. And it becomes like the four hobbits. You have two and two. You have two sets of friends. So I always thought that he did a better job as like the friend in that film, who's going to try to save the other guy from himself, which becomes more and more apparent at the end when he like jumps into the ocean to get him. And Frodo's like, "Well, you can't even swim." And he's like, "I don't care. I'm not going to let you hurt yourself."
Yeah.
Which I thought, came across really, really well. Every time they like always pull out a sword, and he's like the first one to do it because he's like the he's there to help his friend more than anybody else. He doesn't care about the ring so much.
Yeah.
And I like that one because it has the one. First of all, they do a really great job like introducing all the exposition. It's fun. It's engaging. It has the one. Thorough through line. They're all nine people all together. They lose a couple along the way, and one dies at the end. The other films are also great. I don't know if they're perfect because they keep splitting off into the different groups. And every time you're watching the Battle of Helm's Deep and you go back to the trees, you're like, all right, the trees, like they're
They're
still
still
talking.
talking.
Yeah. Which, at the time, well, the first time I saw it was amazing. And after a while, I was like, I don't know. Like, I just sort of skipped those scenes.
Well, you need it the first time you see it just to give you some like mental break from all the fighting. And also like the fight the battle isn't even that long. It doesn't take up that much time of the film. Like it's a, I think we talked about this with Game of Thrones the other day. It's like, you know, that
Yeah.
whole battle took most of a 90-minute episode, whereas in, you know, at Helm's Deep, it takes 24 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, the build-up is the best part, which they also tried to do in Game of Thrones, but I don't think nearly as effective as the massing of the Uruk-hai in front of Helm's Deep,
Yeah.
which is just, it's just so in the rain. It's just such a great scene. I'm sorry, it's just so fantastic. But you're right. Yeah, that movie is the has a through line. It has a single story that is being told, and characters are added to it, kind of like, you know, clay onto a sculpture, and then bit by bit they get kind of lopped off for one reason or another. It's certainly far. It's the best of the three of them for that reason. It's, you know, it's narratively got a lot more going for it, which is true in the books too. Like the beginning of that book, like that first book of those three, it's a lot of exposition and talking, but like that you can follow. The latter books, which I barely finished them, it's just a lot of action set, you know, and which the filmmakers did a pretty good job of portraying, but it was just clunky set piece after the other, fight here, fight there, go there, move this thing here. Like, it was just plot points moving with no character developing at all. Mm-hmm. Stuff had to happen, and a ton of stuff had to happen in lots of different places all at the same time. So, mm-hmm. I also don't like Elijah Wood. I don't think he's a very good actor. I think he's a worse actor than is Sean Astin. And I think the other two are actually better actors than the two of them. So, like, you know, they were very big weak points for me. You know, even Orlando Bloom, you know, like he can kind of get away with it because he doesn't have to do anything.
Right, he didn't have to do anything. So.
But that dead stare thing, did I ever tell you that story? Or you probably heard it too in the documentaries where he decided that his character wouldn't understand death. So whenever somebody would die, he would have this kind of like quizzical look on his face. And it reminds me of this episode of Friends where like Joey first gets cast on a soap. He's talking about his like first day on set and how all these people he meets were really nice, and they taught me about this and about smell the fart acting. And they're like, wait, what? And he's like, yeah, well, you have so many lines you have to learn so fast that if you get stuck, just kind of pause and look like you're smelling a fart and give yourself time to get to figure out what the line is. And like, then you see him do it in the show. Like your sister has a long pause as he like kind of froze his brow. Subdural hematoma. And that's the look Orlando Bloom has whenever a character dies. It's just like smelling the fart acting. He's just looking wistfully, which incidentally makes no sense because as much as the elves are immortal in that they don't age, they do die. Like, they're not impervious to things. So why wouldn't he understand death? I mean, it doesn't. So, yeah.
Doesn't get out much.
It's one of those things where, like, you know, Peter Jackson had enough to do without having to tell Orlando Bloom, look, you know, you look pretty stupid, Lando. You don't want to do that. Yeah, just get it and move on.
Mm-hmm. So. All right. So, what do you have?
All right. Well, in the interests of interestingness, I will remove Jaws and LA Confidential from my list just because I don't want to repeat the conversation, but they were on mine and I have my five now.
So
again, in no particular order, number one, Apollo 13.
Okay.
Number two, Raiders of the Lost Ark. Number three, Die Hard. Number four, Jurassic Park. And number five, The Shawshank Redemption.
Okay, what was the first one?
Apollo 13.
Apollo 13.
So I started watching that, I don't know, like 2 weeks ago, just because like I needed something to watch, and it was like, you know, with the baby, you're up sometimes, you just gotta put on something so you don't go crazy. And I'm looking at it, I'm going, there's no like weird part of this movie. There's no actor who stands out as being miscast. There's no like, you know, like the whole thing. It has a good start. It does, you know, it has, and you know what's going to happen the whole time. You don't need, you know, but the tension is there. And, you know, they're even watching it still, you kind of wonder, like, are they going to make it this time kind of thing? And they always do. And, you know, it's just, the costuming looks right. The set design, everything about it, you know, there's, the woman that plays his wife isn't some blonde bombshell. She's just a normal, you know, Houston housewife who happens to be married to an astronaut, kind of a thing.
Yeah, but all the scenes with her are so boring.
She has very few.
Ugh.
I don't know. In the beginning, it was funny. Like the two of them are drunk and they're sitting there laying at the moon, sitting there staring at it. She gets into, you know, a fight with the guy at NASA, and then the daughter, like, there's very little of her in that movie. She has maybe 20 minutes of screen time. She has to go in and console the kid and tell his son that there was an accident on the spaceship. And yeah, like, there's not.
I find Bill Pullman there a little bit odd, too.
Bill Paxton?
Exactly. That's my point. The third guy.
Well, he looks like Fred Hayes.
So he's not an amazing actor.
No, but there was, I don't know, I think of all the movies I've seen him in, this one sort of makes the most sense, because that's the kind of guy that Fred Hayes seems to have been. He was I forget where he was from, somewhere in the South. And, you know, like a lot of people ended up in the military flying planes. And next thing you know, he's an astronaut. He kind of sticks out in that regard. He has this sort of gregarious Southern charm that the other guys do not have. Like, you know, Gary Sinise is very cold. Kevin Bacon is just sort of handsome. And Tom Hanks is Tom Hanks. So he sort of sticks out like he's the only guy with sort of an outsized personality. But that was part of it. But there was, when he needs to be serious and give information, that part of his character doesn't overwhelm it. Like, he plays up being goofy and kind of almost like simple for a guy who's an astronaut.
Mm-hmm.
But there are, you know, serious moments in the film where the three of them are up there arguing or screaming at each other, and like, he doesn't let some of those character descriptors define every moment of the film. Like, I remember when we were watching Star Trek Enterprise, and the guy who played Trip, Connor Trinneer, you know, was talking about the fact that he was supposed to be a Southern boy, even though he's from Florida, which I thought was kind of funny. And we don't think of Florida as the South, even though it is, but it's different than, like, Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
But he was saying that, like, you know, after a while, I requested there be fewer references to pan-fried catfish, because it was just a thing about, you know, like, he just said it in every, you know, every episode he was in. There was something about, you know, keep your shirt on, Lieutenant, and pan-fried catfish, and, like, it began to overwhelm the character, to give it, to have these little quirks and traits and things just be shoved in your face. And he, you know, because he's a good actor, he pulled that crap back. And, you know, the essence of that aspect of the character's description was there, but it wasn't hitting you in the face like a wet fish all the whole time. And that's kind of how I thought Bill Paxton handled it in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, when they're up there and, like, it's, like, sad and they're scared, and, like, he doesn't, you know, overdo it then. He's really playing it very subtly. And that's, so it's more range than he shows in most of his movies. His best role, by the way, you know what that is, right?
When he was in Aliens.
No.
Yes.
Okay. I've never seen Aliens, but his best role was in True Lies.
He was good in that, too.
He played the used guy. I mean, that's when you can let that fly and just be over the top Bill Paxton. You know.
Well, that's what he was like in Aliens, too. But he was, like, younger and not as good. So it was, like, really over the top and, like, unwieldy Bill Paxton.
Yeah. He's better at True Lies. So Raiders. Then, I'm sorry, Apollo 13 and then Raiders. Which is, like, is there a sour note in Raiders of the Lost Ark?
I don't know. There is that point. Doesn't he, like, hang on the submarine for a while?
No. There's the controversy of how he gets into the submarine. But that, like, they mentioned that in an episode of The Big Bang Theory. You know, where, like, there's, like, you know, 13 seconds of additional footage in this, in some kind of a special screening that they're going to see. And they say it totally solves the submarine controversy.
I like how he gets in.
Yeah, and like, it's not ridiculous. He swims across the water, climbs on the submarine, opens the hatch, and gets in. Like, if you saw the submarine dive with him standing on top of it, then you have to go, yeah, that doesn't make any goddamn sense. But you don't. You just see him waving to the guys on the ship, like, hey, look at him, he made it. And then he just kind of runs across the thing, and then you cut to that little map thing where you watch the red line go to the island.
And then the whole part at the end where he's tied up and just closes his eyes. That's not anticlimactic at all. I mean, a little bit, right?
I don't think so. I think that you see everything, so you get the full effect of the faces melting off and all the Nazis getting their themselves shot with lightning. So you get to see the thing inside there. I mean, there's no way to make that, you know, good. But the fact that he misses it and they wake up and they're all gone, they're just on this island by themselves. It's an important moment for him when he's standing there like an hour before that holding a bazooka about to blow the whole thing up, and he's just like, you know, if you don't give me the girl, I'm just going to blow up the whole thing and then we can forget the entire Enterprise. And the guy says, fine, go ahead, do it. And he can't, and he allows himself to get captured because he wants to see what's in this thing so badly. But then when a push comes to shove, and he's like, wait a minute, that's the thing. We have to not want this. If we don't want it, it's what's going to help us survive. So he makes a choice right there to say, I'm gonna give up on this because it's, you know, it's wrong that we're doing this, even though this is all he does. His entire life is based on taking these things from the places that they have been left. And, you know, the whole movie, they're saying, like, this is scary. This is a big deal. This is unlike anything you've ever done before. And he's like, it's no big deal. But he realizes, no, this is, you know. So to me, that's a, you know, it's not belabored. It's just like, shit, shut your eyes. We're not going to survive this. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, it's just, you know. It's like little gems in that movie. Like, I love the thing with the hangar. You know, everything about that movie is great.
Oh, yeah. The hangar.
But that guy, too, he's just so creepy, you know. What shall we talk about? It's, oh, God. He was an agent, too. He wasn't even an actor. He had been an actor, and then he retired and became an agent, but then like came out of retirement to do that movie.
Well, yeah, you can tell he's not really an actor.
Yeah. So... And then Die Hard, you know, pretty classic. There's sort of not much to hang your head on and say this was a bad part of Die Hard.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, if anything I don't like about Die Hard is, you know, and it's nitpicky, is that the computer hacker they have, who's the bad guy, the young, skinny black dude, he's in another movie. I don't know what he's doing.
He's sort of out of place with the rest of the,
with like villains. The group he's with. Yeah,
like they're all sort of East German lunatics, and he's not. But they're there. I mean, they're there just to rob the vault, and so I don't know. It's the closest thing that it's not bad. It's certainly entertaining, and it's certainly sort of terrifying too, because he comes in and he's sort of like, you know, like brash and very street for that late 80s sort of vibe, and then he's like okay with them murdering all the security guards.
Yeah, he's like really campy because the rest of the vibe doesn't fit around him.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, he's not in it much. I'm just saying, like, I always found that character to be kind of strange in that, like, that was what he was doing and they were okay with that. You know, I was like, all right, they're going to let him do that sort of thing, I guess. I yeah. Like, you're telling me Alan Rickman would put up with that, but okay.
Well, I mean, it speaks to the idea maybe that, like, he was so valuable a team member because he could, you know, he had a skill set that none of them had, that they would put up with him and his antics.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, he just, I mean, I don't know. It makes them look a little bit more interesting as a group of people than just a bunch of grumpy East Germans. Like, if you think about the guys from Die Hard 3, it's just, you know, it's what's his name? Jeremy Irons on the phone the whole time, and you know, he has no other. There's no more personality to their group than just those guys. So right. this guy has at least more to him than grumpy German number four.
Yeah,
you know. And then now Jurassic Park, I'm surprised you didn't have.
You know, I don't normally complain about the acting so much, but since we're on that topic, who's the woman?
Laura Dern?
She's terrible.
I don't know. I thought she's good.
She's not, though.
She doesn't, like, none of the acting, except for Jeff Goldblum, because he was just Goldbluming everywhere. None of the actors sort of stand out to me. Like, Sam Neill's really understated. She's kind of understated. Richard Attenborough is, he's great. But, like, he had that little avuncular kind of, you know, gnome running around the island. And then, like, Nedry is kind of, he's goofy looking because he's just so fat. But, like, this is, like, Sam Jackson's most toned-down role of all time.
Yeah,
you know, like you kind of forget he was in this movie, and he had a less, you know, it wasn't a huge part, but it wasn't a small part either. He's in it the entire movie.
It's also strange to me that this doesn't happen in the novel, where the storm comes and it knocks out all the power, combined with the computer hacker, all the fences come down. You know, they're stranded on the island because of that. But they're alone, and in the book, they're just stuck there with everybody else. So you see, like, you know, red shirts running around getting eaten by animals left and right. And in the movie, they couldn't, like, afford all the extras, I guess. And so they make a big deal that everybody's leaving for the mainland, and you have to stop whatever you're doing, get on the boat before this hurricane hits. Except everyone we're watching, they just stay behind. Like, that's no big deal to them. And I always found that to be so odd. Like, what an odd oversight.
I forgot that. Like, I read the book so long ago that it just didn't stick in my head.
Like, obviously, they didn't expect, you know, the animals to get out. But you also don't want to be stranded on an island with animals after a hurricane.
Well, I think it sort of speaks to the hubris of the experiment. Was to say that everyone's getting off for a time being, and that's okay. Like, they believe it's fine. He there's even a line where he says, you know, you can run this entire place with minimal staff for up to so many days, all from this room, setting it up like everyone's going to leave and it's going to be just us here. And I think it works better in a film than in a book to have everyone. Well, maybe not. Maybe it works just as well in either case. But, like, I think it sort of enhances the horror that you're the only people on the island.
Well, that's why it...
filled with raging dinosaurs.
Like, you don't really notice it because now you're only focused on a certain group of people. You know, most of them who make it out, but not everybody. Rather than, like, the dumb scenes in Jurassic World where 400 people are running down the street and dinosaurs are chomping at them as they go.
Yeah.
I also find that, and I don't know how they get away with it. I mean, it bothers me, but, you know, when the T-Rex comes out, chews the cars, mm-hmm. and then the T-Rex pushes the car over the side and it goes down the cliff and Samuel has to go down and get the kids. Why is there suddenly a giant cliff?
That's a moat.
But the T-Rex wasn't in a moat when it was behind the fence. Only when I got out.
Okay.
Right? He eats the goat. Goat, like, falls over the fence. It comes out of the, you know, it's... I'm doing the hand motion for those of you who can't see.
He's literally just chomping his hand.
Yeah. And then when it pushes the car over the side...
car goes flying. Continuing with the motion of the hand. Yeah.
It's a visual thing. The car goes right over the side, like, and it falls into a tree like 60 feet below. And that wasn't there 10 minutes earlier. Yeah, I just wanted a cool zine. I get it, but
I mean, it sort of makes sense from a zoo design point of view that you know would design a paddock to be separated from the barrier even by a drop. But you're right, the fact that it escapes from the paddock with relative ease means that there is no moat there, but like, you know, it's like when you go to the Bronx Zoo, there's like, you know, lions 20 feet away. Yeah, but there's like an 80-foot drop between you and the lions.
Right. Like, there's no way the lion's making that jump. I am not worried about that.
First of all, it's way too drugged up to do that.
Right. It's so doped up, it doesn't even know what it is. So that's always been a... And it's not like a game-breaking thing. It's... Because you're still watching this intense scene, you don't even notice it happening.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, of all the things to worry about there with the giant dinosaur, where'd that hole come from?
Yeah, where'd that hole come from? And, like, why did they climb all the way down there? How did the thing climb all the way up? Like, it literally doesn't make any sense. And they didn't care, so.
I guess.
But I have watched that movie 70,000 times. And every time it's on, I'm like, oh, Jurassic Park. like without fail, I will put it on.
Great opening, too. It's just that, like...
Oh, it's just a wonderful film. The book is good as well. Everybody should read the book.
Yeah, the book... There's some key differences in the book that don't really make or break anything or change anything. Like, the fact that Grant is sort of like a... sort of jocular... heavy set bearded fella, you know, who's not grumpy, who's actually, you know, rather, and like likes kids. Like, the whole thing in the book is that in the film is that he hates kids, which, you know, I guess there's no really, you don't have to give a character a reason to hate kids, because people sometimes just don't like kids, and that's fine. But in the book, he talks about how, like, he likes the fact that kids have enthusiasm for this extremely complex and, you know, challenging area of science, and he loves that they know the complex names of all the dinosaurs, you know, and like they're all in Latin, for Christ's sakes, and the kids have no problem, you know, handling them. And you know, in the movie, that's just like they needed him to have friction, you know, with the characters that he encounters, and like so he can kind of grow to love the kids that he has to save. You know, right. Wouldn't have worked if you hadn't given him that trait to begin with.
And John Hammond's character is totally different too.
Is he?
Yeah, he's not this benevolent old grandpa guy that just wants to wow the world. He's like this ruthless, pioneering, he's like Walt Disney if he was a bad guy, I think is what they were trying to go for. So like, it's his hubris that also dooms the park, you know, because they come up to him a bunch of times and they try to tell him like, these aren't exactly dinosaurs and they're kind of a little, you know, dangerous. And he's like, I don't give a shit, that's what we're paying for, I want more people to see it that way. And that's why he gets eaten. In the book, he gets eaten.
That's true. He does die in the book. I see. I forgot that. I've
read this book. You should read it. It's good.
I did, but it was 20 years ago. So,
I mean, you know, more recently.
Yeah. I mean, I think it works better. Because evil business tycoon guy is.
It's not as good.
Yeah.
Different.
Yeah. I think this is better because there's this wonderful scene between him and Laura Dern when they're sitting in the cafeteria and they're eating all the ice cream, which I think is just great. Like, all this chaos is happening outside and they're locked in this building, you know, safe for the time being, and just eating ice cream. And he's talking about his first job running a flea circus. It's great. He's saying, like, you know, it's all little motorized thing, and the kids would come up and they could swear they could see the fleas, And she says to him, like, it's the same damn thing. You realize, like, it's all an illusion. None of this is actually real. You've created this thing, but, like, the place you put them in isn't a real place. It's just an island with a bunch of, barbed wire fences, and you built this, terrifying thing, and now it's going to eat us. It's just, it's, I don't know. That's why I like her in that movie, because she doesn't have much to do, but the thing she does do is pretty good. Like the whole thing when he like moves her head to look at the brachiosaur. I don't know, she's good in that movie. I don't know what you're talking about.
That's horseshit. All right, and one last one. What do you got?
Shawshank.
Shawshank is too long. Shawshank is too long
Yeah,
of
but
a
like what can
movie.
you pull from it where it's just like, oh, well, that bit of character arc didn't need to be developed or whatever.
You could pull 30 minutes out of that movie easy. There's so much of that where like there's the guy he suspects really killed his wife. Whatever. Who cares about that guy?
That's the whole thing that tips him over the edge.
There's all the
That's
scenes
the.
of him getting beaten up. How many scenes of that do you need?
Well, that's important because there's this sort of jovial camaraderie about guys in prison where it's just like, hey, look, if prison was all, William Sadler and Morgan Freeman and the other fat guy, prison isn't that bad. It's just kind of like, the food's terrible. But like, no, he's fending off rapists for the better part of 2 years.
It's just so drawn out.
It's a prison movie.
And that's
Like,
like
of
the
course
part
it's
with
drawn out.
it's the part with like the old man when he gets out like halfway through, and they show what a horrible time he has adjusting to civilian life so that he kills himself.
Right. But like, you
That's
can't
also
lose.
a very long scene. I was like, how long of this guy's life do we have to watch?
It's
Oh,
maybe
he's dead.
10 minutes. It's maybe 10 minutes. And it's crucial too, because it gives people a sense of like what happens to you if you're here for too long, is that you can't, like, you want to leave because you're in prison and prison is bad, but like you can't once you do, because you've they've taken from you something that can't be given back, which is your ability to survive in the world. Like, I hear people talk about this all the time in terms of like capital punishment, and people who are against it are saying, well, like, well, capital punishment is not good because, what if the person is innocent and then you kill them? You can't undo that. I'm thinking, well, yeah, but if you send someone to jail for 45 years for killing someone when they didn't do it, you can't undo that either. That takes a different kind of thing from you. In one case, it's your literal life. In the other case, it's your metaphorical life. You can't function otherwise, and you end up killing yourself. So, and it just informs the decisions of, your two main characters to not end up like that. Like, there's nothing in it that's extraneous. Could you shave a couple of minutes off here and there in terms of like how long of a pregnant pause did this character have to have before this happened? Fine. But like, there's nothing in the movie that you look at it and go, well, you could just, take that entire thing out of it, or that chunk of the story out of it, and it still functions. It's like everything still informs on something else, to the point where like if that wasn't there, you might wonder why certain things were, or why certain characters made certain decisions. Whereas with A Few Good Men, you could take that entire scene out of the movie in the beginning, that flashback scene, and the movie could even improve.
I guess. It's not like I don't like that movie.
It is long. It's not. It's a long movie. But it's sometimes you gotta make a long movie.
Yeah, I mean,
Lord of the Rings are 4 hours long each.
I don't know. I'm not a big Hollywood film star, so I don't know what you would change, but every time I watch it, I'm always like, oh, I'd like to see this. And then I think to myself after 5 minutes, I just want to see the end. Because I don't want to get through all this other stuff.
Yeah, the end of that movie is just my favorite scene in the probably in cinema, is when they go in and they find the like the cell empty.
Right. Like that part's great.
Oh, and
And
like,
even then, it goes on and on after he gets out with Morgan Freeman.
I would say that would be the only point of the film where it really feels long.
It feels long because like you're
Because,
not sure how much farther it's going to go.
Right,
It never
yeah.
seems to have an ending. Like he's in the parole, like he's hanging out in the prison. Okay. Then he's in the parole office and he's still talking. Okay. Then he's in the then he's working in the shop and you're like, how much longer of this are we going to watch?
Yeah,
Then he's looking for the rock. Like, yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point. The fact that he goes through all of the same things. I don't know how you edit it down better, but maybe you can. But that's the one point where it's just like, well, your main character is out of prison now. He's
right.
gone. You know, and you see him like go like, because he tells the whole thing in flashback. So like, you know, you see him going into the bank and handing out the thing, and then they come for the warden and the whole thing. But yeah, like he kind of has this moment where he's still there, you know, still waiting to get out. But anyway, yeah, no, it's still necessary. You have to see him stand there on the brink and decide not to do it. Not to do, you know, go the same route that Brooks did. Even when he writes his name in the wood the same way that Brooks did. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anything else?
No, I think that's everything. Although we're a bit late to the party, if you out there want to tweet us what your top five perfect movies were, you can do so on Twitter and Instagram at Three Drinks in Pod. We are available on iTunes, Google Play, and wherever you get your podcasts. Click subscribe, tell your friends, leave reviews. There's the Facebook page, threedrinksinpodcast@gmail.com. Not sure what we're going to tackle next, but we'll try and be back as soon as possible. Anything else?
No, I think that's it.
Okay, everybody. As always, please drink responsibly, and we will talk to you all next time.
Yep, take care.
Bye.